Well, welcome to the Davis Arts Center. Thanks for coming out, everybody. This is going to be a wonderful reading with Linda Scheller. Poet, playwright, teacher. Linda's publications include Notre Dame Review, Poetry East, Plays, Connecticut River Review, Santa Fe Literary Journey, a journal. Three of those I'm even like afraid to send something in. Her book is Fierce Light from Future Cycle Press. There's copies over there for sale. Ms. Scheller is a board member of the Modesto Stanislaw Poetry Center, is in the Modesto chapter of the National League of American Pen Women, and is here to read some poems for us right now. Please welcome Linda. Some water.
Oh, thank you. Thanks so much for coming today. Thank you, James, for inviting me. I'm going to start with actually a song. This is from my book, Fierce Light. These are all persona poems in the voices of women from different time periods, places, occupations. And this is Barbara Strozzi from 1619 to 1677. I was happy to be part of a collaboration between music composition students at Stan State and some of the local poets. So this tune was composed by Bradley Rogers, and I thank him for giving me permission to sing it today. Where sovereign music leads to hill or vale, in spirited delights that toss the heart and join the souls of lovers soon to part, or chambers of a king with marble pale, in graceful wending dance that stills the gale of duty for an hour holding court. There I must follow in melodic art, composing music noble patrons hail. But no, my name will fade from lips and pen. For men disdain my sex and only see the fairest face and form as currency, despite the joy my songs engender when their notes reveal my rare ability. Fame grants sweet immortality to men. Thank you. So I'm going to read a poem that is unfortunately very relevant right now. This is for Tsuyoko Sachs Kitashima, who lived 1918 to 2006. And it's entitled Family 21373. The wind sprays dust through the cracks, coating us on our cots. My teeth grate against sand. The child in the next room wails. Too hot to sleep, I imagine the past. The house in California, the land my parents were not allowed to own. They truck farmed strawberries, lettuce, celery, tomatoes, and cauliflower. After Japanese language school, my brothers and sisters and I joined them in the fields. My sister and I plowed, one holding the reins, the other holding the plow. Rainy evenings, I played piano. My mother was always singing. I remember Oshogatsu, the men pounding rice, the women shaping mochi. Perhaps that year, 1941, someone forgot. Perhaps someone swept. Ministers and teachers disappeared. Police shone spotlights through our kitchen window. Radios and cameras were confiscated. On telephone poles, notices appeared announcing the evacuation. We could only take what we could carry with two hands. We sold the tractor and the car, the furniture and piano for a pittance. Our old horse that used to pull the plow was destroyed. The bus took us to Tanforan. We slept on hay in a horse stall heaped with manure. For 3 months, we were incarcerated behind barbed wire. Then soldiers holding guns took us by train to this concentration camp. "Don't go near the fence," the guards yell. Mr. Wakasa walked too close. He died, shot in the chest. The wind shrieks. I pull on my boots and tiptoe past my sleeping family. At the toilets, a young mother stands in line with her daughter. The girl clutches her doll, a daruma with one eye. This eye is the girl's wish, our wish. How long must we wait before she can draw the second eye? The last poem from my book that I shall read is for Beatrice Potter. This too is a sonnet. The one I sang previously was an Italian sonnet, and this is an English sonnet. And Beatrice Potter lived from 1866 to 1943. You might know her as the author, illustrator of The Tale of Peter Rabbit and many other charming books. Each crooked twig articulates the tree. A lace of bone achieves the body's architecture. These compel my eyes to see, my hands to sketch and paint. I dwell in nature's residence, observing every detail, quite alone with beauty and my animals. As fruit may hide a stone, so grasses hide a teeming world of spiders and decay. Soft, busy mice, shrewd cats, the patient, cold amphibians portray the foibles of humanity in miniature. With line and tone, I copy and experiment to render nature visible to all. The picture letters blossomed into little books, which bought my independence and my farm, my life among the sheep and pigs within the realm of Wordsworth. Everything I sought, I found in nature, learnt its lessons well, and heed its call to flower in the shifts of light that cause the heart to leap. I'm going to read poems that I've written in the last year or two that haven't made it into a manuscript yet, but this first one is entitled Superstitious. Symbols and portents abound. Two pair of quail, a sudden lack of owls. Coyotes roam the river and fields recline with brown hands open. In my dreams, I try to get home, whatever that means. All airports snarled and trains delayed. I find myself outside the wooden bungalow on Ovalau, in my pocket a shell, its pink sheen smooth as the inside of my thighs. In divination, direction matters. East for childhood, west for death, south for discovery, north for change. Trees gesture acquiescence and leaves tremble in shades of green contingent on some fleeting state of being. Contentment, wretchedness, confidence, insanity. The dog on the back porch howls. He tries to join the coyote's song, but it's no good faking what you're not. As I wait in tonight's subway station, I count the tiles to derive divisibility, hoping for that first prime number, even as breathing. Jackhammer. Creature of good intentions, you borrow a car, pass 18-wheelers at 95 miles per hour and lose your way, arriving too late to help. A yellow umbrella sails past the windshield, nylon unreeling from one slender rib in a dance of cholera. Creatures like you feed the blood of mice to your familiars, ask questions of clothing, experiment with truth. Creatures like you exercise what you consider to be a man's right to play fast and loose with a woman's heart. In this room, at least two of us loved you madly, the sort of love that ends in broken homes, police reports, and fistfights you recall with pride. You picked me out of the crowd years ago because of my body and apparent willingness to make a fool of myself in public. Perhaps you might have even meant what you said to me before the river flooded, before my brother died, before I quit my job, before you changed your mind. The green world speaks in excess in brief flower. From my palm, your face leaps up and drills into my chest, a jackhammer. Dismay colors my memories. I dip the photograph in water and watch us disappear. A Stanislaw. Between the Stanislaus County Superior Court and the Hall of Records, a Stanislaw steps forward toward the intersection of 11th and I. Pedestaled and fenced, the insurgent alcalde's limbs and face catch shadows in bronze as sleek as manzanita, while behind his back, lawyers vie for white justice, that pliable, heavy justice mined from stolen lives. Soldiers caught and missionized the Yokut people, swapping their land for toil, their joy for captivity, their freedom for the promise of eternal ease postponed. A Stanislaw ate the Padre's doctrine and drank their prayers. He administered their justice to his people until the Padre's cruelty drove their faith from his heart. A Stanislaw gathered his people and led them east. General Vallejo followed them, and they fought, killed many soldiers, and chased the survivors west. A Stanislaw dreamed of Abraham beside the flames, binding his son as sacrifice to the Padre's God. And when he woke, the manzanitas whispered his sins. A Stanislaw left his people, returned to the mission, knelt, and confessed. He bound his heart with shadows and ripped it from his chest, placing it in the Padre's fire. Is he honored here in bronze as a leader of warriors or as the penitent savage who chose subjugation? A Stanislaw steps forward and raises one arm, palm open in greeting, warning, surrender, attack. At his feet, Modesto's homeless crouch in reeking dirt and whisper riddles into their tattered plastic bags. The remainder of the poems that I shall read today come from my latest manuscript, German-American, which I'm still seeking a publisher for, but I trust that it's definitely time. I'm looking back at my family, at my heritage, at my legacy of guilt and silence, and I've divided the manuscript into three sections, the first being Familienaufstellung, which means family constellation. I'm going to read August, which I wrote for my maternal grandfather. Cupping the match flare, he lowers his face to the flame, guiding the cigarette with a toss of his jaw upward like a horse testing the reins. Leaning on the smooth wooden handle, he studies the sky, calculating the angle and force of autumn. October in Niederkirchen meant new beer and bratwurst, sauerkraut, schnapps, singing and dancing with pretty girls wearing dirndls, braids flying as they spun like colorful leaves in the wind of accordion music. Tonight, when the field is raked, the cows milked, the horse fed and bedded with clean straw, he will take down the concertina, sit on the back step, and play the old songs to the same stars seen by his family back home. This next poem is an acrostic. I wrote a sentence vertically, and then every line begins with that letter. This is a matter of birthright. Heaven blessed them with a son, God's best gift, elevating the second over the first, a mere girl. In her hands, she holds a tray. He sits between their parents, served by her, balancing bowls of lentils and rotkraut. Just like father and grandfather, he is the rock, adamant in his innocence. Catalogued by pronouns, children learn their value early. Strangled by old appliance cords and tightly knotted aprons, brittle magic writhes like smoke inside her skull. Invasive species, she is borrowed, temporary, a rib. Ash and gasoline make her bed, while her brother moves to the music of yellow light and numbers. Eve's descendants bleed in penance. They tell her silence is the shadow cast by sin. Apple peelings augur domesticity, initialing her destined lord, unknown, but as inevitable as the waning of life. Sister, a miscarriage. You left us incomplete, details merely imagined. All secrets denied, a refuge for the spirits of our grandmothers. What braided kinship, what whispered darkness, what jealous lessons. What rooms do you inhabit now, little sister, unrealized and nameless? For my father, the brown velvet rose I brought for you stays in the glove compartment under the card that tells you how I feel. I leave them thinking another time if time permits. Dented storage containers circle the cabin like dogs shot in the act of protection. I enter knowing winter is coming. Tar paper sags on the cabin walls. Beside the wood-burning stove, an open tin of fish sits on a crate, but otherwise the cabin is empty. A solitary window faces the lake, deceptively calm and dark with secrets. This is my inheritance. Acid drips from the eaves, burning a moat that keeps the spiders in where they belong. The moon rises above the lake, like someone else's fortune, and I cannot help but sing. The second section is entitled Krieg, the German word for war. I read a lot about the 30 Years' War, World War I, World War II, and just got back from 2 weeks in Germany, where I would go into the Rathaus and look at the photographs of Würzburg bombed to nothing and weep. And of course, the more I'd learn about the atrocities committed by my ancestors and family, and the the more I weep. This may have some bearing on the present, and in my manuscript, I try very hard to offer parallels for our consideration between what we see here and now and in other countries and what happened in Germany in the 30s and 40s. Separators. Gross caricatures leer from posters. Der Stürmer lights the fuse in mind. Brown shirts smash windows, burn books, bash skulls, patrol the cobblestone streets. The problems must go to Madagascar, work camps, ghettos, or clinics. Trains punctually convey them elsewhere. We vie for the spoils. A number, a star, skin darker than parchment, but a glance tells, sentenced. Looking back, you have to wonder why we loved him. Stirred by an eastern wind, millions of eggs hatched. In the veins of the trees flowed yellow sap. New leaves emerged white and fell into the streams. We asked aloud, how can we feed our families? The first step was taken by letter, a petition for mercy. The baby's parents begged for heaven where he might be whole, and our leader said, Jawohl. Newsreels and photographs of the wealthy taunted the starving. Clouds of cholera gathered, muttering vague threats and vomiting propaganda. From the south, warm air breathed on slithering larvae. The trees pressed closer together, blackening the earth. On twisted roads, metal flashed in shafts of sunlight. The unwanted were carried by bus to special hospitals where they died of pneumonia and heart attacks, all 200,000 of them. Able adolescents donned uniforms and began to disappear. As we worked in the fields, the heat wiped its melancholy hands across our faces. Bile heaved in our guts, squirming with bitter suspicion. Pupae slept, rocked in the cradle of the west wind. Leaves burned red and flew like sparks as we walked narrowing paths with our fingers thrust deep in our ears. The phlegm in our mouths and throats thickened until questions drowned. Inauspicious minerals tripped us, yet no one cried out. Silence spread apathy, and the hearth of fear smoldered even in our dreams. We told ourselves that hunger for honor justified complacency. We were wrong. Winds from the north flung imagos at our door. Snow burdened the trees until the venerable cracked. The sound of breaking limbs was lost in explosions. Blood of fathers, brothers, husbands, sons, and lovers mixed with the blood of the Jews, Slavs, and Roma. Skies thick with smoke offered no stars. Protest, even veiled criticism, brought death. Everyone worked and held their breath, choking on the fumes. Stacks belched. We should have asked what burned. A wife waits for her husband away at war. With dawn each day, I rise and eat the bread like dust. Choke water dense as blood. The house contracts with silence. Shadows catch my hem. The vacant chairs, expanding table, mausoleum bed. How carefully I dust them, straighten his picture, wash my solitary cup. Yesterday, while beating rugs, a sudden storm possessed me, and I screamed with every blow as if to detonate my lungs. For once, Last night I slept while dreams of childhood rolled through darkness. Clouds of flour, sweet white beaches of sugar, Oma in a yellow apron scraping dough by the spoonful from the chipped mixing bowl. She frowned at me and brushed aside a lock of variegated hair before receding into morning. Another day. It seems to me that as I wait for war to end, I might as well go get his tools and patch the roof before the rains come. And the third section of my manuscript is Märchen, the fairy tales. And I read a lot about the fairy tales, not just the fairy tales themselves, which I grew up hearing, but, you know, the experts, Bruno Bettelheim and others, who said, among other things, that it's very important that you tell them, not read them to someone, but tell them, because then you are emphasizing that which is important to you and that which is universal and has been passed down. This is Rumpelstiltskin. The lie led to impossible challenges, with death the prize for losing. A greedy little man claimed the child as payment for what should have been common mercy. There he is, spinning straw into gold, while she weeps in silence. This is a braided poem. I wrote three narratives. The first is in bold. This is the voice of homeless children in America, right where I taught, maybe in my class. The second line and then every third line thereafter in normal type is the story, the Pied Piper, as I told it and had heard it. And the third line, and then every third thereafter in italics, is the voice of those who were part of the final solution. The Pied Piper. There were always places to hide. After we refused to pay him, we were collected, and if we couldn't find our mother, we sang the old songs. They demolished the ghetto. We stole food in the cobblestone streets, our prison. In the little corner stores where the children played their games, we were packed into boxcars. When the clerks were distracted, they heard a flute, a one-way trip, back to our hiding place beyond the city gates. They took the men after eating the stolen food. The children ran toward the music, away from us. We told each other stories, and they all disappeared. We undressed, drifting off to sleep forever, except pale clouds hissed. We whispered our prayers to the only child left, strangling us, Jesus, who could not hear. This, too, is an acrostic. I added another challenge in that I not only wrote a phrase, a very, very common phrase in the end of the happier fairy tales, but I also ended each of the stanzas with that word. And so this is called And They Lived. Half is not enough if magic grants all to those who give their all for peace. The oak holds fast to earth, yet pulls itself skyward cell by cell, inching upward toward heaven. Light calls us, and some answer. You and I interlaced, flower happily. Every morning, I imagine your profiled visage and vow to write the world for you. Each quest, a wind I ride, a journey far removed from you, yet closer ever. After the sun embraces the rising night, footsteps whisper in the forest. Tell me, love, what you will. Even the moon in her silver gown reflects our joy forever after. And the last poem I'm going to read is another sort of experiment. I had a lot of fun with this section, and I wrote out the story of, well, Cinderella, Aschenputtel in German, and then I took those words and phrases that seemed to me most important and archetypal, and then put these strips of paper into just a bag and drew out 23 of them without looking, and then rearranged them. And I ended up with three poems that I could live with, and this is Aschenputtel 6. A woman stood over the grave after the others had gone, knelt under the tree, watered it with her tears, turned, asked the white bird, "Do you have any other?" Near death, the father tried it on in turn, walked down the aisle, saw her, deceived. For the rest of their days, the stepsisters never suspected it was she who fled home, dancing. The pigeons flew down with great joy. Seek the first branch. Thank you.